In Durban, South Africa, thousands of men and women poured into the streets in front of the International Conference Center there, where United Nations talks about climate change are taking place. NPR's Richard Harris is at the talks and listened to the speeches, songs, and other appeals to diplomats to do more and act quickly in the face of a rapidly changing climate. He joins us now from the Conference Center. Hello there, Richard.
Hi, Audie. How are you?
Good. Richard, this weekend marks the midpoint of the talks. Can you give us an update on the status?
Sure. Well, the first week of the talks is generally taken over by the lower-level negotiators. Let's remember what they are trying to do is come up with an agreement of some sort to help slow the pace of global warming, an enormous task. The negotiators who've been here this past week have been working on text and sort of trying to get the ducks in a row. What happens over this weekend is the chief negotiators show up, the heads of the delegation, and they have usually more maneuvering room from their governments to actually cut deals.
Once those diplomats get there, what are the points of contention at the moment that they're going to have to take on?
Well, the two biggest are really what the futures of these negotiations will look like and money. As for the future of the talks, the key part of the Kyoto Protocol, which was enacted in 1997, was negotiated, will expire at the end of next year. And the big question is, what will take its place? Will there be a second commitment period under this treaty, or will there be something else that will be substituted for it? And that's a very, very delicate point here, because lots of people have pretty well given up on the Kyoto Treaty. The United States never signed on to it. China has no obligations under it. Canada, Japan, and Russia have all said, we're done with this. And Europe is still hanging on to it a little bit, and the developing world is really, really wants to see it go forward. But that's not really looking like that's going to happen. So the backup is, what will a deal look like after Kyoto? And can we find something that will do the job?
And to go back to something you said earlier, Richard, you mentioned money. What's the issue there?
Well, the issue is how the developed world, the rich nations of the world, are going to help the developing world. And at a similar meeting last year in Cancun, negotiators agreed to set up something called the Green Climate Fund, which would ultimately funnel about $100 billion a year, taking it from the wealthy nations to the poor ones to help them adapt to climate change and to develop cleaner sources of energy. Of course, the details of that fund are very contentious. They've been arguing over language for a whole year, and they don't really have an agreement yet, except in principle, that that fund should exist. So those issues are being hashed out here, and that's obviously of great concern. By the way, it's not just government aid money we're talking about. It would also be money from private industry as well. So $100 billion a year is a lot of money, but it's not. We're not talking about foreign aid here.
Richard, given what you've said about the various degrees of commitment that different nations have to this issue, how should people measure success from a meeting like the one in Durban?
Well, I guess success in some cases is the avoidance of utter catastrophe, which is actually a potential outcome of this meeting. But let's start from the most optimistic scenario, the people who really want to see new promises for action, new sort of targets for emission cuts before 2020. They're still holding on some hope, although they will almost certainly be disappointed. The U.S. officials have said the goals that were set in Copenhagen and ratified in Cancun are good enough to get us to 2020, and they're not interested in notching those up at all. So that's probably not going to see major motion. But the question is, maybe there could be some framework, some idea of what a treaty would look like post-2020.
And lastly, Richard, the climate talks switch cities every year. I would think it gives it a different flavor. So what's the atmosphere like in Durban?
It is summer here. It's kind of warm and rainy, and people are wearing short sleeves. It gives it kind of a casual feel. Walking around, people are still pretty casual about not only in clothing, but in attitude about how things are going so far. And they know that, you know, the tough work really lies ahead. The suits will go on, the ties will get tightened, etc.
NPR's Richard Harris at the United Nations Climate Talks in Durban, South Africa. Richard, thanks so much.
Sure.
In hard times, comfort food can be reassuring. So perhaps that's why one of the latest foodie trends shouldn't be much of a surprise. Gourmet meatballs, anyone? Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf takes note.
If you live in New York City, you've seen this coming. The meatball shop opened last year in the Lower East Side and has been so popular, there are now three of them offering meatballs with your choice of sauce. Uptown is an Italian restaurant called Polpette, translation, meatball. A few weeks ago, the Meatball Factory opened near Gramercy Park. There's even a bartender, excuse me, mixologist, in New York who makes what he calls a meatball cocktail. It involves frying spicy sausages, then draining the fat into Irish whiskey. At the recent New York Wine and Food Festival, the Meatball Madness competition was sold out. The Judges' Choice Award went to the Little Owl Restaurant's Gravy Meatball Slider, a recipe from the owner's grandmother. They sell more than 1,000 a week. The madness is spreading. Meatballs are served with butter and thyme in Chicago and made of foie gras in Minneapolis. L.A.'s Great Balls on Tires meatball truck urges patrons to join the Reballution. Meatballs are now on the menu at Applebee's and neighborhood delis. And in the nation's capital, James Beard Award-winning chef Michel Richard, known for sophisticated French cuisine, has just opened a restaurant called Meatballs. Do they even have meatballs in France? Americans think of meatballs perched on top of spaghetti, all covered in cheese. But meatballs are universal. Spanish albondigas are popular tapas. Greek keftedes are made with lamb and mint. And Japanese sukune use chicken and ginger. Thai, Chinese, Vietnamese, Moroccan, and Indian cuisines all feature spherical meats. And let us not forget the Swedish meatball. Variations on these themes are played out in the new meatballeries. The Meatball Madness winners included a goat curry ball and a rabbit ball. There are meatballs made with lean meats such as bison and ostrich. There are jambalaya balls and turducken balls. There are even vegetarian meatballs, whatever that means. And if you want to make balls at home, at least 6 new books have been published in just the last 2 months focusing on the food orbs. Why meatballs? They're affordable and familiar. They're a happy food in hard times. To quote from the new Meatball Shop cookbook, meatballs are the ultimate cure-all for anything that ails you.
Bonnie Wolf is working on a book about the foods of Maryland's Eastern Shore. This is NPR News.
Back to domestic politics now. The suspension of Herman Cain's campaign may deprive late-night hosts of their best punchlines, but they'll still have plenty of presidential hopefuls to keep them company. It's become an unwritten rule of the road in presidential campaigns, the proverbial grilling by the kings of late night. Back in 2008, David Letterman was stood up by then-presidential candidate Senator John McCain for an interview, and Letterman got all fired up because he knew the power of his couch.
First of all, the road to the White House runs right through me.
That always
Presidential candidates made over 100 appearances on late-night TV last election season, up from just a meager 25 in 2004. With the Iowa caucuses just weeks away now, Mitt Romney, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry have already made rounds on late-night TV. So why is it so important for presidential candidates to visit The Tonight Show or The Daily Show while on the campaign trail? With me to answer this pressing question is NPR's Ken Rudin. He is the political editor for NPR, also the author of NPR's Political Junkie column. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Rachel.
So I want to start out with a clip from a show I recently saw last week. This is Michelle Bachmann on Jimmy Fallon. Here she's playing this word association game with Fallon. And in this challenge, Jimmy Fallon says Perry, as in Rick Perry, and Bachmann has to say the first word that comes into her mind. Let's take a listen.
That's not one word. I've got to do three.
Yeah, dude.
Governor, Texas. Can't remember that.
Oh, my God.
This is timely. This was coming off the heels of Rick Perry's kind of flub. Why do presidential candidates feel they need to go on late night TV at all?
Well, first of all, I think more people get their news from Jimmy Fallon and Seth Meyers and Jon Stewart than they do from Brian Williams and regular network TVs. Second of all, candidates are not campaigning the way they used to. They're not on the ground in Iowa, New Hampshire. They are doing debates, they are doing Fox News, and they are doing late night TV. And third of all is that it helps soften your image. When Rick Perry couldn't think of the third department that he would cut, the famous oops brain freeze moment, you go on TV, forget about the mistakes, you forget about the gaffe, you show that you're human. And for some people it works, but does it give you a boost in the polls? Perhaps not.
And this has been happening for a while. I mean, it's the temptation to say this is all a modern thing. But Richard Nixon went on Laugh-In, I mean, a long time ago.
The buzzword at Laugh-In in 1968 was Sakatumi, and they would always have these other celebrities go on. The thought of Richard Nixon going on and saying
Sakatumi?
I mean, that was so bizarre because Richard Nixon wouldn't do that. Remember, he's not a relaxed kind of guy. Richard Nixon doing Sakatumi on Laugh-In back then was a big thing. When Bill Clinton played the saxophone, microphone. And that was 19 years ago. I remember people thinking this was unspeakable. I mean, that this is unprofessional.
Yeah.
And yet that's the way to do it, because there are a lot of people who pay attention, as I said, to late night TV and these hip shows rather than Meet the Press and Face the Nation, things like that.
Have these appearances really become inculcated into a political strategy?
They have. We haven't even voted yet. We've talked about these candidates for 9-10 months already, and the first vote doesn't come until January 3rd in Iowa. But until then, if you're not the focus of a debate strategy, if you're John Huntsman and you get very few questions, why not go on Saturday Night Live? If you're Michelle Bachmann, who seems to be forgotten by most pundits, why not go on these shows and make jokes? Will it help you? No. Will it keep you in the spotlight? Yes, and that's what the name of the game is.
Ken Rudin writes the weekly Political Junkie column. It can be found at npr.org/junkie. Ken, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rachel.
L.A. Woman, Hello, I Love You, Light My Fire. The music of The Doors is as popular today as it was in the 1960s when the band was filling clubs up and down the California coast. The Doors were unpredictable, mysterious, even frightening, and audiences couldn't get enough. Music writer Greil Marcus was there, too, witnessing the band's epic rise and fall. He's now written a new book. It's called The Doors, A Life of Listening to 5 Mean Years. I spoke with Greil Marcus and asked him what draws people back to The Doors after so many years. And he said, sure, it's the music. And yes, it's Jim Morrison. But what really makes the band magnetic, even still, is something deeper.
There was a sense of dread all through their music, a sense of shying away or walking away or running away from anything that smelled of a happy ending, because that was going to be false, it was going to be sentimental. And in these times of assassination, of war, of riots all through American cities, they caught that current as something that everybody felt under their skin. The argument that was going on in the music was, look out, watch your back, be ready to run at any moment.
I want to play a little bit of an example of that idea, of that theme, of the darkness, really.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end.
The Doors use that space a lot. They take advantage of silence and pauses between notes.
You know, listening to that passage you just played, those opening moments from the end, listening to Robbie Krieger's very, very few notes on his guitar, that says something's about to happen. It's not going to be over quickly. And you may not be exactly the same as you were when you started to listen. That's a fearsome prospect, and it's also incredibly attractive. Who's not going to open that door?
In the book, you do, to a certain degree, tell the story, tell the narrative of the band. But a lot of this book is just your meditation on the music itself and thinking about these songs. One of the songs you talk about in your book is Mystery Train. What was Morrison's approach to this song?
This is an old Elvis Presley song. This is a song that real Elvis connoisseurs have always loved. And the Doors love this song. It starts out with a wonderful clickety-clack train song.
16 coaches long.
And then Jim Morrison, it sounds like he's just jumped on the train, looked around, doesn't like what he sees, and he starts singing the song in a slobbering, messy voice.
Will there be no train? Come, my baby, he's gone.
As if this isn't the train he wanted to be on. And in this case, you find Morrison drifting through the song, getting off the train, getting back on the train, and other songs begin to come into his mind, and moments come where suddenly he is on the train and he begins to shout. The band finally is coming up behind him, again with this clickety-clack and clickety-clack, and you don't want this to end. You don't want the train ever to reach its destination, but finally it does, and they slow the song down. You feel the train slowing down, and they go right up to the railhead. Jim Morrison sings the lines with which he began the song. People get ready for this train to glory. And that wasn't the train you just rode on. You rode on a train of confusion, of desire, of fear. That wasn't what the ride was about at all.
I'm speaking with Greil Marcus about his new book. It's called The Doors, A Life of Listening to Five Mean Years. What changed for you now as you listen to this music after spending so much time with it?
You know, spending a lot of time with this music for me meant going to their shows in 1967, playing their records when they came out, but really hearing the music on the radio over the years, and a lot more so over the last 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 years than ever before. Roadhouse Blues and L.A. Woman, two of their greatest recordings, were not hits when they were released in 1970 and 1971. You didn't hear them on the radio then. You hear them on the radio now. These are songs that became hits over 40 years.
What was it particularly about L.A. Woman that has given it such staying power? I mean, you hear it all the time today still.
It's the sense of ordinary everyday life. It really does have the feeling of somebody walking down the street, talking to people, talking to himself. If they say I never loved you, you know they are a liar. Driving down your freeway. You know, maybe a little addled, maybe a little crazy, but someone who's just full of exuberance and wants to tell everybody about it. Cops in cars, the topless bars.
I wonder if through this examination, this very close look at this music, if you discovered new things.
Yeah. You play a song again and again and again. You let it drift past you. You turn, listen to it as hard as you can. And you never know what's going to hit you. And what I hear as the whole of the music is a feeling that we don't know what the next day is going to feel like. We don't know if there's going to be a next day. And so you better say what you mean. You better tell what you're afraid of. You better do it right now. Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss, another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss, another kiss.
In 1971, the Doors' lead singer, Jim Morrison, flew to Paris, and he died there. But all kinds of questions lingered then, even today, about the specifics of his death. And, you know, it shows how he became the star of mythic proportions. Is it possible to divorce the power of this music from Jim Morrison?
When I listen to this music, I hear someone who's alive and who's struggling and who's trying to get something across. I hear someone who's beset with confusion and moments of really uncanny clarity. Somebody struggling to say what he wants to say, and so many times succeeding.
That's Greil Marcus. He's the author of the book The Doors, A Life of Listening to Five Mean Years. Greil, thanks so much for talking with us. We really appreciate it.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
With all the stories of economic woe across the Atlantic, we've decided to look at what Europe's debt crisis means for this country. So we've invited in NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giwax. Welcome, Marilyn.
Hi, it's good to be back.
So a few days ago, our own Federal Reserve Bank stepped into this crisis, right? The Fed joined other central banks to make it easier for banks around the world to get their hands on dollars. So why would we do that? Because at first it seemed like the U.S. really wouldn't get too involved in this.
Well, it can seem like Europe's troubles sound so far away, and especially at a time when our own job market is still weak, home prices are still falling. You'd think we have plenty of things to worry about right here at home. But really, we are so tied to the European economy that the United States cannot afford to ignore this European debt problem.
But how does it actually affect us?
Well, there's several ways. I'll start with just the simplest one. The European Union has 27 countries, and together, they're our single biggest trading partner. We do about $500 billion worth of trade with Europeans. And, you know, they're very good customers. That means U.S. corporations get a lot of profits from Europe. Those profits help prop up our stock market. So Americans have a lot of interest in seeing Europe continuing to grow. Believe me, whether you are a coal miner in West Virginia or a corn grower in Iowa or maybe a chemical plant worker in Texas, you do not want to see your European customers cutting back on their spending. We need Europe to stay healthy to maximize our own exports and our profits.
Okay, so that's the issue of trade. I mean, are there any other connections that we can better understand this?
Well, we don't only trade with Europe, we also compete with Europe. We want to sell our goods to customers in Asia and the rest of the world. So if Europe's troubles are driving down the value of their euro, they have an advantage over us. German exports have been booming for a couple of years now, in large part because this falling euro has given them a competitive advantage.
So it makes their goods cheaper?
Exactly. Think of it this way. Say you're a customer in China and you're trying to decide between a German car and an American car. If their currency is cheaper for you, well, the German car is going to be the better bargain, even if it really isn't the better vehicle. So that's a pretty unfair competitive advantage. But everything we've talked about has really just amounted to small potatoes compared with the really big issue, and that has to do with the banks.
So what is happening with the banks? And by banks, you mean the Europe's banks or what's happening here in the U.S.?
Well, it's both. Because whether we like it or not, big financial institutions are global today. You know, if you looked inside your own wallet, you might find an HSBC credit card. That company's based in London. Maybe you've got your savings with ING. That's a Dutch company. The reality is that our financial systems are really woven together. And unfortunately, the banks in Europe own a lot of the debt that was issued by those European governments. So if Greece or Spain or Italy or any of those countries suddenly defaulted on their debts, those European banks would find themselves becoming insolvent. They'd be holding a lot of worthless assets. And that would be horrible for us. You remember in 2008 how bad the financial markets were when they were melting down?
I was going to say, I've got a feeling of deja vu here.
Yeah, we all remember that feeling pretty well. 3 years ago, it was U.S. housing debt that triggered this. It could be that European government debt could trigger the same kind of contagion. But the big thing is coming up this week. In Brussels, the European leaders are going to get together. They're going to try to come up with a comprehensive plan. And some economists are actually fairly optimistic at this point. They think everyone understands how high the stakes are. But don't break out that French champagne just yet, because they've got a lot of work to do to really address the core problem of dealing with all of that government debt.
NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Giewax, thanks so much.
You're welcome.